You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
It's Fitz, and if you don't know who I am, here's a quick bio. I'm a veteran sports journalist who writes, does TV, radio, and is a longtime podcaster. Also, I have stage 4 prostate cancer. During the initial stages of the 2020 pandemic, my doctors advised me to stay at home. But now, 2 years later, I'm not only healthy, but I've been declared in remission. But I'm still continuing this podcast, during which I'm calling the many friends, athletes, coaches, and colleagues who I've met throughout my 30 years in this industry. And now I'm also calling some new people to make some new friends. Oh, and I'm hitting the record button. Welcome to my life and the Life of Fitz podcast. Hey everyone, it's Fitz. And you know what? I started this podcast 3 years ago when the pandemic was roaring and I was locked up at home, fearful of going out because I had active stage 4 cancer. It caused me to decide to start calling friends. And not just call friends to catch up, but to incorporate work. Kind of what I do, I guess. I called a lot of friends. That first season had great discussions. And the following season, I shortened it because there was sports again. I had much more to do with work. But we just did a nice little, 12-episode season or so. Caught up with some people. They were great conversations. Two of them were Matt Miller, the former K-State quarterback, and former Kansas State president John Leufold. Both, as I start this season 3, are gone. It's hard to believe. Matt Miller died right around Christmas, right in the New Year, so a couple days following his dad's passing. And I'll get into President Leufold later in the season, but I wanted to start this season by revisiting Matt and speaking with his older brother Marty, who is a scout with the Jacksonville Jaguars in the family business of football. And this is where I want to start season 3. This one is for my friend Matt Miller, and bless his brother Marty for being on this episode of the Life of Fitz podcast. And now, let's call Marty Miller in Boise, Idaho, where I learned during this conversation is where he lives.
Hello.
Marty.
Fitz, how are you?
Good, brother. How are you doing, man?
I'm doing all right. Good talking to you.
So what's going on today in your busy life?
My busy life, I am doing a little bit of work. I'm a scout for the Jaguars. I'm watching some game tape of the Titans and the Texans and doing some reports.
So when you say scout, are you like a scout of other NFL teams or a college player scout?
Predominantly college players, but we have an occasional pro reports that are due.
Okay.
And as we get to know our team better, one of the things they have us do is watch the other teams in our division and compare our players with players on other teams in our division. So that's kind of what I'm finishing up right now. So it's a good project. Get to know our team and get to know the teams that we play most often.
Are you Jacksonville based or?
I am based in Boise, Idaho.
And I did not know that.
Yes, so I scout primarily the West Coast and the Northwest part of the U.S., it's been a good situation. I've been here 13 years, and we really love it. Boise is a great town.
That's really interesting. It's a beautiful city, isn't it?
Oh, it's great. It's been great. It's grown a lot. Actually, the housing market has really taken off here in the last few years, so that's been nice as well.
One of the things I love about this podcast, and by the way, this is the podcast, this is all we're going to do, I get asked people stuff, and this is totally random, and I never expect to ask this. Would Boise be a good fit in the Big 12?
I think Boise would be a great fit in the Big 12. I mean, they would have to increase some sports, I think, probably add some sports. They don't have a baseball team, and there's certain sports they'd have to add, but I think they'd be an outstanding fit, especially from a football standpoint. It's a great program with, you know, a good tradition here, and they've won a lot. I think they'd be competitive, and they play a good brand of football. So I think it would be a good fit.
Here's a really hard-hitting question. How do you feel about the blue field?
I do not love the blue field, but it's hard to watch. I agree with that sometimes, but I do like the notoriety it brings to the city. Most people, when you go anywhere, know something about Boise, at least besides potatoes.
That's true. That's very true. I'm not a big fan of the blue field, and someone has a red field too. I'm like, what are we doing here? Don't know.
Yeah, Eastern Washington has a red field. I think Central Arkansas has a purple and gray field. So there's a few of them out there now, but Boise is the first.
No. Well, it's not been an easy 6 months, 8 months for the Miller family. It's been a ride, hasn't it?
It has not been ideal, no. Yeah. Starting with 2 years ago when Matt was diagnosed with cancer, and at that time when he was diagnosed, you know, the prognosis was fairly grim from the beginning, and so we knew it was going to be an uphill battle for him, and, you know, unfortunately, you know, at the end of the year last year, he started feeling really sick again, and, you know, when he went into the hospital around Christmas time is when they had basically given him the news that he was not going to make it much longer. You know, coinciding with that, right around Thanksgiving time, my father had had a heart attack and had gone into the hospital and just never really recovered from that heart attack. Briefly did a little bit better, but then by mid-December, it was pretty clear he was not going to make it much longer. And so that kind of set up the beginning of the year for us to kick off the year not in an ideal situation.
Yeah, it was the 1-2 punch. How did the family handle all that?
I think my father was 84. His health had started to decline, so you didn't expect him to live much longer, I don't think. But still, when something like that happens, you're not expecting it at any time. Like I said with Matt as well, you know, we knew that he was sick and was struggling, but still, it's a lot to take on, especially at one time, especially for my mom. You know, she'd been with my dad since she was in high school. They're both 84, so they've been together a long time, and, you know, change is difficult. So when that happens, you know, my brother and my sister, older brother and older sister, we kind of had to divide and conquer. My sister spent most of that time with my mom, and then I flew into Kansas City around Christmas time to be with Matt. And then my brother, older brother, went back and forth between both my mom and me to kind of help out during that time. But it was a lot to take on, and I'm glad we had one another during that time. It was definitely, I said it was a gut-wrenching experience, but it was also very life-affirming, friendship-affirming with the people that rallied around Matt. And I think a lot has been written and said about that time. So it was obviously tough to go through, but you really learned a lot about yourself, learned a lot about Matt, learned a lot about my family and our friends during that time. And, you know, so much support. It was outstanding.
Well, all of us who knew Matt knew his life was kind of a roller coaster, and he went through some real struggles. But no one deserves what he faced at the end. Advanced prostate cancer is as ugly as it gets, and he didn't fit any of the parameters for a person who should have advanced prostate cancer, but. That's what it is. I mean, he was much too young, and it was incredibly aggressive. But, boy, he fought like hell, didn't he?
Oh, he did. And I think that, you know, we used to joke when Matt was young, he was not the toughest kid in the world. So you gave him a pacifier and a blanket and put him on a chair, and he would sit there for hours. And he loved to be held by his mom, and, you know, he – cried a lot and was not the toughest kid in the world, but boy, he overcame that and was super tough there at the end of his life and during his. I think that epitomized, I think if you watched him play football, if you watched him play sports, I think that's what people would say about Matt, that he was extremely tough.
Yeah, Matt's decline was just, it was painful. I mean, it was just unbelievable to watch someone that had been so healthy and gotten himself back kind of on track, and to have this happen is just, it's unfathomable.
Yeah, it really was. And, you know, there was a little bit of, you know, he had, his third round of chemo had started in November. And that was something that he wasn't sure he wanted to try to go through again and endure. And, you know, I had talked to him on the phone a couple of times, and finally I just said, you know, and he even echoed this, was that if he didn't give it one more shot to try to fight it one last time, he would always regret it. And so he went through that round of chemo. I went and visited him in November, and that was a great time. We were able to go out and play golf. We went to some restaurants. We went back to our childhood home and kind of walked through our neighborhood and had a lot of time to, you know, catch up on memories and go through things in the Kansas City area and meet with friends and get together and just do a bunch of things. And so that was really nice. But shortly after I left, around Thanksgiving time, he started feeling, you know, really bad again. And it was clear that the chemo was not working. And he did not want to spend Christmas at the hospital. He had done that, you know, the year before. And, you know, that was the last thing he wanted to do. But there on the 23rd of December, he just was too sick at home and went into the hospital. And then on Christmas Eve, he called and said that the doctors said that they just couldn't do anything else for him. So, you know, that's a very difficult phone call to get.
Yeah.
And he was obviously just brokenhearted about that. And initially I was pretty bitter and upset with his doctors for telling him on Christmas Eve, because it was just a rough Christmas. But in retrospect, you know, thinking about it, it was really the best thing that could have happened, because he was able to call his daughters, get them to come into town. He was able to spend Christmas with family and get people there to be with him. And, you know, he had a lot of friends in Kansas City who rallied around him. And, you know, it was a situation where after Christmas, I talked to him and I said, hey, I'll come there and I'll be with you until the end, however long that is. And my work was great with me, and they let me go and be with him. And I got there, you know, my plan was to travel on January 4th. And then three or four of his good friends called me on December 30th and said, hey, I think you need to get here right now. Mm. And so I got on a plane, flew there. I got there Christmas Eve, got to Kansas City around 11:45 p.m. on Christmas Eve, was able to ring in the new year with Matt, and he was awake and talking. And, you know, we had a great time that evening. And so I was able to be there on the 31st, and, you know, it was a great experience. And we'll kind of talk more about, you know, how that all, it ended up being an even more amazing experience. The fact that I got there on the 31st and, you know, was able to spend 4 or 5 days with him, that where he was really lucid and aware. And had I waited 4 or 5 days, I wouldn't have had that time. So I was very grateful to his friends for intervening, because one thing about Matt, he always put a positive spin on the situation. So if you asked him, you know, what did the doctors say, he would always say, you know, I'm doing better. I'm, you know, he just didn't want people to be depressed about his situation. And so you never had a great gauge on the time frame of what they were telling him, because he would always say, you know, I think if they said you've got 3 months to live, he would say, I've got 6 months to live. Mm-hmm. Or, you know. And so towards the end there, you know, I needed other people that were around him to tell us, you guys need to get here right now. And my wife and I flew there and were able to spend that time with him. And, you know, that hospital experience, I think the KU Med Center said he was the most visited patient they had ever had in the cancer ward. It was a steady stream of people coming to visit him. It was absolutely an amazing experience to see the outpouring of love and friendship with people just coming to visit him in those days. Unbelievable.
Well, it was that ongoing optimism Every time I talked to him, he was so upbeat, so happy. You would never know from talking to the man on the phone, because you couldn't see him, that he was dying. And he knew he was dying, unless he really, really beat the odds. But he never gave up the hope that he was going to be the one to beat the odds. And that's kind of the way you need to approach it. It just didn't work out.
Yeah, I think that optimism, it rubbed off on everybody who saw him and visited him in the hospital, even the nurses and the doctors. That's a very tough situation, tough job to have. I can't imagine the stress and the heartache that they feel, but they do an excellent job of also detaching themselves. And it was clear that they were not detached from Matt. They loved Matt. His doctors loved Matt. The nurses loved Matt. One nurse in particular, took care of him. Every time he went into KU Med Center, she always went out of her way to take care of him and his daughters and take care of our family, brought us meals, did our laundry for us. I mean, it was incredible, the outpouring. Another one of the nurses, the last few days, I think on January 4th was when Matt really took a turn for the worse. And from the 4th to the 8th, he was, unconscious or, was non-responsive to us. He basically slipped into a coma at that point and was, sedated heavily and was not active. And one of the nurses, on those days, came into the room, talked to us and said, "I've never cried in this job ever, but Matt has meant so much to me and your family has meant so much to me that I had one day I just had to go out to my car and sit in the car and cry." And that's just something that I think Matt's optimism and his attitude had worn off on people, had rubbed off on people to where they had a great, great deal of love for him, even though they really didn't know him that well.
Anyone who works in medical profession is amazing to me. But
oh, incredible.
Those people that work in cancer wards or with cancer patients, I've dealt with them, and they're just a different breed. I don't know how they can pick themselves up and go to work every day and deal with people who are quite literally fighting for their lives. And unfortunately, when they get into those situations where they're hospitalized, they're probably going to lose. Often they lose. And to deal with that every day, I just bless them. I don't know how they do it. I have no idea. Yeah, yeah. When my work gets stressful, I think of those people and like, how do they put up with this stuff?
And every morning there was a debriefing time where his team of doctors would come in. They would go through his charts and what they'd done for him the day before, and talk about the situation. They did that every morning, and the family was in there with them, and we got to hear that. And towards the end, I think it was the third or fourth day that I was there, they came in and they told Matt, what they had done the day before. And basically then his main doctor at that time just said, "Matt, I need to put this in terms that you'll understand." And he said, "Okay," because he just kept fighting and coming up with ideas of things, have we tried this? Can we do this treatment? Have we tried this medicine? And finally, his main nurse or main doctor said to him, "Matt, you are losing by 30 points right now, and there's 1 minute left in the game, and you need to take a knee." And when she put it in terms like that for him, you could just see it was terms he could understand. And he said, "Well, what if we do this?" And, he was not going to lose by 30. Mm-hmm. He was going to throw a couple of Hail Marys out there. If he was going to lose, he was going to lose by 14 or 16. He was not going to lose by 30 points. He was not going to go out like that. And he kept fighting until the very end. And, even though they had told him, "Let's transition you to hospice type care and we'll make you comfortable, but there's just nothing else we can do." And when they walked out of the room, I think the realization really sunk in for him. And it was a couple hours later that he said to us, I just want to be comfortable and I don't want to suffer. And I'm ready. And that was tough to hear him say. That was tough to hear him say, and, you know, obviously tough for all of us to go through. But, you know, he had begun to live his life, and he would set goals, time goals. So he'd say, I want to reach my daughter's graduation. I want to reach this date. And one of the things he said, I think, on Sunday, the Tuesday coming up was the Kansas State LSU football game. And he said, I want to watch K-State play one more time. And I want to do it with my family, and I want to have a steak dinner. And all of a sudden, you know, it sunk in that he had set these goals, these time frame goals, and now his life had narrowed to the point where those goals were now days or hours. He was just hoping to live that much longer. And, you know, he was able to make it to the K-State game. He wasn't in a great mood that night. Hmm. He was feeling really bad. But he was able to see the Wildcats, you know, pull out one last victory. So, you know, that was a special time for all of us to experience that. And K-State meant so much to him, meant so much to our family, that, you know, that was a neat moment to have. We were all decked out in gear and, you know, had a great time watching the game together.
When you've gone through watching a brother kind of wilt away, is it hard to balance those memories of the final days with all the great things, the great memories you have?
You know, his spirit was such that, yeah, now I look at pictures of him in the hospital and I realize how sick he was. But, you know, his attitude was so good and you were having such a great time with him that it didn't feel that much different than, you know, I think on the last Monday night, the night before the K-State game, was one of the best nights. He was in a great mood. All of his, I mean, there were COVID protocols in place at the hospital, so we were having to cycle people through. But I would guess that 20 to 30 ex-teammates came through that evening. Mm. And, you know, cycled through during the course of the night, and everybody told stories about Matt, and he laughed. And at that point he was eating candy and, you know, doing all kinds of things that, you know, eating donuts, anything unhealthy. He was not eating healthy anymore. He was having bags of candy and guzzling them down and, you know, drinking Cokes and doing all kinds of stuff. People were just laughing and telling stories about the time they had with him. And That was really a special moment. You know, teammates from grade school on up through his time at K-State in baseball and football. It was a really special night. And so I think that was a great moment for him. And that was a special moment for everybody. And, you know, then by Tuesday evening when he went to sleep, you know, he was not real responsive from there on out. But, you know, by golly, he was as tough as nails. His doctors told us, I don't think he's going to last much longer once he went into kind of a sedated state. But lo and behold, he, you know, hung on for 5 days. Mm. You know, and did not want to go, I don't think, you know, at all. And even in the midst of that toughness, a tough situation, he was fighting until the very end. You know, it was a testimony to his grit and determination.
Before we get into some of the great stories about Matt, you do have a memorial coming up in July. Fill me in on the details, fill in everyone in on the details of what's going to happen in Manhattan.
You know, a number of people had reached out and said, you know, at the time of, you know, you're just so overwhelmed as a family. We just took a step back and so we like to do something for both my father and brother this summer. And there's an event in Kansas State where a lot of Kansas State football players are in Manhattan, where a lot of Kansas State football players are coming back there the first week of July. And so we talked with people there, and there were people who reached out and said, let's do a memorial for Matt around that time. And so Thursday evening, I think it's July 7th, we are going to do a memorial for Matt in Manhattan at the Bluemont Hotel. And, you know, anybody's welcome to come out who knew Matt and experience life with Matt. And we're just going to, ex-teammates are going to speak. Coach Snyder's going to speak and spend about an hour and a half just celebrating his life. I think that'll be a good moment of closure for a lot of us and his family and for teammates, people to be there. And so that'll be Thursday, July 7th from probably 6 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. at the Bluemont Hotel. So we'd love to have anybody come out who wants to. And the night before, actually in Kansas City on Wednesday the 6th at 5:30, we're going to meet at a restaurant in Kansas City and just kind of tell stories about Matt and my dad. At a barbecue restaurant in Kansas City called Meat Mitch. And so, you know, anybody, either Kansas City or Manhattan, if you make either of those events, we'd love to see people there and remember Matt and remember my father. And you know, we'll look forward to that, just being able to relive great times, hear things talked about Matt.
Hey, it's Fitz. Let's hit the pause button right here and take a little break.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odyssey podcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odyssey podcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/odyssey podcast.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
So Matt was such a force. I mean, he really was. You could see him, whether he was on the football field or coaching or just living life, he was a force with which you had to reckon. And I imagine there's some great stories about your brother. Give me some young stories about young Matt Miller. I love the fact that he needed to take his naps, because I can relate to that. I just did it before I called you. But he had to be something as a little brother.
He was something. I'll tell you. One thing we talked about is his lack of toughness when he was a little kid. My mom would always tell the story when he was in preschool. After his first day of preschool, my mom would pick him up. The teacher said, "You've got to do something with your son." He cried. He cried all day long for you. So much so that all of the kids were crying. She goes, he made everybody cry because he was crying so much, calling for his mom. And so she talked to him and sent him back to school the next day. And lo and behold, about midday, teacher called and said, "You need to come and pick him up. I can't deal with him anymore. He's crying all day again." So my mom drove up to the preschool and pulled him aside and said, "Now, Matt, why are you crying?" He said, "I miss you and I want to be home with you. I don't like being away from you." And she said, "Well, Matt, I'm going to tell you something. If you don't stay in school, they're going to arrest me and put me in jail, and you'll never see me again. So you need to make sure that you stay in school. Kid never cried one more time. He went to school. He was not going to have his mom go to jail and have him not be with her. So he gutted it out, stayed in school, never cried, you know, and made sure that mom was there for him the rest of his life.
That's funny.
And that was just kind of how Matt was. He was a lover and not a fighter, definitely, at that point in his life. You know, one of my favorite stories about Matt, too, was the first year that he had played flag football a couple of seasons. And Ben, he was just a naturally gifted athlete. So in flag football, he was so dominant that he was big and fast, so much so that that second season he played, my older brother was his coach. The championship game, they decided that the only way to make it fair would be to play Matt's team versus an all-star team of all the other teams in the league. And so they took all the other teams' best players and put them on one team to play against Matt's team, and Matt ran all over and ended up winning that game. They went undefeated. And then the next year was his first year of tackle football, so he was extremely excited about that until we realized that there was a weigh-in system. And so you had to make a certain weight in order to carry the football. And so Matt went and weighed in and did not make weight. And so they, back then, you could never do this now, but they took a big, like a hazmat sticker. It was like a triangle. It was neon, like a neon yellow or neon orange. And they stuck it on players' helmets who could not carry the ball. And so Matt had this neon orange sticker triangle on his helmet. And he hated that. He had to play offensive and defensive line. There was one game where he intercepted the pass as a defensive lineman. He started running. He was so excited that he was finally going to get to carry the ball. And they blew the whistle immediately because they didn't want anybody to get hurt by this big kid running around. And so he never got to carry the ball. And he made sure that that next year he was going to make weight. So he made weight. And, you know, that next year he's a quarterback and, you know, never moved from the position. But he hated that sticker on his helmet and made sure that that didn't happen again.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah, you couldn't do that now.
No.
No. Was he a natural quarterback or just someone that, because he was the best athlete, he ended up playing quarterback?
I think he was a natural quarterback. I mean, football was ingrained in our family. My dad was coaching at BYU when Matt and I were both born in Utah. You know, we've been around football our whole lives, and so it was ingrained in us. And you know, one thing that I think was a big advantage for Matt was the fact that we had a lot of friends. I had a lot of friends. He had a lot of friends, and we were all the same age. So there's a lot of families whose kids, there's a 3 or 4 year age difference. So we all grew up playing games together. And so Matt, you know, at a young age was playing with kids that were older than him and being challenged and pushed. And so, you know, it was an idyllic situation for us growing up. Our backyard was the baseball field for the neighborhood. Our neighbors, we had neighbors that had a great backyard for football with a big space. So we, you know, we would wake up in the morning, and if it was the summer, we would wake up, we would go outside and play baseball all day long, maybe go to the pool for a couple hours in the community pool and then go back and play more baseball. And if it was the fall, we did that with football. And it was pretty clear early that Matt was a natural at quarterback and had leadership skills. I think that was one thing that was evident in dealing and talking with people, is that Matt really had a unique ability to lead people. People wanted to play with him and play for him and sacrifice on his behalf. And he was willing, I think it was because people knew he was willing to do that. And he was just unique in that Matt had an ability to relate to anybody. And I think that that is a key element of a good leader and a good quarterback. It didn't matter if you were from a small town in Kansas, you know, and grown up on a farm, or if you grew up in an urban, any inner city situation, Matt, he connected and related with guys and had a unique ability to be friends with just about any type of person from any socioeconomic upbringing race, creed, thoughts, you know, what Matt just related with people, and people love Matt. And that was evident with the people that came to visit. It was just a cross-section of cultures and people that Matt connected with. And I think you probably experienced that in dealing with him.
Yeah. I mean, he just was magnetic. He just kind of wanted to be around him because he was generally Matt was so happy. And when he put off that kind of energy, people want to be around you.
There's no doubt. He was a definite life of the party. We said he was, you know, he had a lot of unique talents. He had a photographic memory, always had new useless facts. He loved to sing and dance. You know, if you got him on a dance floor at a wedding, he was, you know, he'd be like, look at this guy dance, you know, pretty smooth out there on the dance floor. And loved, you know, loved being in front of people. And so it was definitely a magnetic personality and a great leader.
So he ends up at Kansas State playing for Coach Snyder. I don't know. I just feel like no matter how much football you've been around, playing for Coach Snyder had to be kind of a shock to the system. Did you pick that up from him?
I think playing for Coach Snyder and then, you know, coaching with Coach Snyder too. You know, those – the demanding element of Coach Snyder made you a better person. And I think that Matt was so loosey-goosey that, you know, you wondered, if thinking back on him, wondering why in the world would he have chosen to go play for Coach Snyder? But I think that's what Matt needed, was that structure and discipline that Coach Snyder brought into his life. And, you know, Coach Snyder was, Matt loved Coach Snyder beyond description. And, you know, the times that Matt made decisions in his life that disappointed Coach, it was like he had disappointed, you know, he felt as bad about disappointing Coach Snyder as he did disappointing, you know, his own father. Mm-hmm. And Coach Snyder just meant so much to him. And despite, you know, the times that maybe Matt had, you know, had made some poor choices, Coach Snyder never abandoned him and was always faithful to him and loved him. And, you know, so much so that, you know, Matt knew that he could call Coach at any time. You know, Coach Snyder and Coach Clark, the baseball coach, came and visited Matt during the last week of his life. You know, I think that it rubbed off to where Matt, they meant a lot to him and vice versa.
Yeah.
It was reciprocated.
Well, you, as you mentioned, you grew up playing sports, and I, you know, I'm of the same era, sort of, so to speak. And we'd hop on the bike and be gone all day playing sports and hanging out with friends. And, you know, we didn't have video games. Might have had Pong. And nobody wanted to play that. And so you were just immersed in sports. But on top of that, like you said, it was a football family. Not a family of people that enjoyed football. That was literally your dad's life. And of course, I remember him being a player personnel guy with the NFL, and he also coached. What was it like growing up in a house with someone that was so deeply immersed in the sport of football?
Oh, it was unbelievable. It was great. I couldn't have imagined anything. You know, you talk about when you were a little kid, your birthday party some years was at the stadium. My dad would take us up to the stadium and, you know, give the kids a tour and then let us play a game on the football, you know, in Arrowhead on the field. And, you know, what kid gets to do that? Very few. And be around players. Matt and I would go spend 2 weeks every summer with my dad and at William Jewell Chiefs training camp. And, you know, we'd ride around on golf carts with the players, and you know, they'd have nicknames for us. And you know, it was an amazing experience. We would go. One thing my dad did that was amazing is every year he would let Matt or myself, we would alternate. He'd say, pick a college team, whatever bowl game they go to, I'll take you guys to it. And so we went and saw SMU was my team back in those days. And so Eric Dickerson, we went and saw, you know, SMU playing their bowl game. Matt, like Dan Marino, so he picked Pittsburgh one year. We went and saw Pittsburgh playing a bowl game. And, you know, that, you know, it was just amazing. Then we would go to Hawaii to be at the Hula Bowl with my dad while he was scouting that game. And we'd be riding in a car with Barry Switzer or, you know, a famous coach that would ride over to practice with my dad. We'd be hearing the stories and having a great time. Hmm. There's 1 year, my parents got Matt a tape recorder, an old tape recorder that, kind of the rectangular, looked like a stereo type of thing. And Matt loved that tape recorder. He took it everywhere. And we have a tape of Matt when he was probably second grade. And he took that to Hawaii with him when we went to the Hula Bowl, and he was interviewing players. And I can remember Marcus Allen, Matt interviewing Marcus Allen, and we would laugh and laugh and laugh at that interview, because Matt was, his voice was high pitched. Marcus, tell me how it felt to win the Heisman Trophy. And Marcus Allen, to his credit, acted like Matt was Howard Cosell. Well, Red, it was an honor to win the Heisman Trophy, and, to play at USC and to be here talking to you is, a great honor. And it was so great, Matt. Who gets to have those experiences? But growing up in a football family, we got to have them. I was thinking back when my dad took the job in Kansas City, we were coming off. He had been with the Dolphins for three seasons prior, had won two Super Bowls. So, we're thinking, man, football's easy. You just win. And, you just walk out on the field, you win these games. Well, we got to Kansas City in 1976. That was they played 14 games back then. I think the Chiefs had gone 1-13 the year before my dad took the job. And that was a really bad roster. And one thing that they did was, one of the perks of my dad's job was they gave him a company car. So we had this big red car. And because it was a company car, they put a gigantic Chiefs helmet magnet on the side of it. And we had to drive around town in that car. And Matt and I were so embarrassed because the team was so bad. And fans, the Chiefs fans are great fans, but they're still fans. And they would yell at you and say, "You guys stink. And the Chiefs are terrible." And Matt and I would do anything we could to make sure we did not ride my dad's car around town. We would ride with my mom everywhere if it meant avoiding getting in that Chiefs car. But, through the years, the team eventually got better, became a playoff team, and those were great experiences for us. And, we were lucky. We were in Kansas City 12 years. And so, that's a long time to be in one city for an NFL team. And, Matt got to, have a idyllic childhood growing up there in Kansas City. And we still have a lot of connection with the city. And actually, my mom has just moved back there. So after my dad's passing, she decided to move back to Kansas City. She had been living in Oklahoma. So we'll be back there this summer and there more often to visit. So that'll be nice.
Nice. Was it your path to the NFL? Was it kind of a logical progression of events that you kind of followed dad into the NFL business?
Initially, I didn't. I knew that football was something I always wanted to be a part of, but it wasn't until about 6 or 7 years after college that I said, this is what I want to do. And so my first job was with the first XFL. So when the XFL started in 2001, I was a personnel. I got a job working with the Los Angeles team, and we won the championship there. The league folded, and luckily, just through some connections with my dad and working for Al Luganville in the XFL, I was able to catch on in Jacksonville the next year, and that was 2002, and I've been there since. So I've been in Jacksonville 20 years. A great run, and I've been able to experience a lot. And one of the best players, you'll remember this player from our team when I was in the XFL, was Darnell McDonald, the wide receiver from Kansas State. And he was one of our better wide receivers and helped us win a championship there. And so my dad worked in the CFL. I worked in the XFL. My dad worked in the NFL. We've got a CFL championship ring, an XFL championship ring, and an NFL Super Bowl ring in our family. So
that's cool.
We need to have somebody, work in an arena league and get one of those rings and cover all the leagues.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. And Matt was a hell of a baseball player too, wasn't he?
Oh, he was outstanding. Yeah. I mean, that was from a young age. I mean, his freshman year of high school was the only year he was in Kansas City. And our baseball coach, Bill McDonald, legendary Kansas City area baseball coach, who coached both Matt and I, you know, came up to the hospital to visit Matt that last week. And he said, you know, he was brokenhearted when he found out Matt was leaving. And Matt had finished his freshman year with 16 straight hits, not 16 game hitting streak, 16 straight at bats getting a hit is how he finished his freshman year. And
that's
then
incredible.
My family moved to Southern California, which was great for Matt from a recruiting standpoint, really opened up a lot of doors. And his first year in San Diego, you know, he made the varsity there as a sophomore, played on a team that finished in the top 10 in the country. Lost one game all season. I think they finished the year like 25-1 and won the CIF championship in California. And I think finished ranked number 8 in the country. And Matt started 3 years there at that high school that produced a lot of Major League Baseball players and would have been a high draft pick coming out of high school in baseball. You know, the Mets had told him, if you will not commit to football and go straight to baseball, we will take you in an early round. But he was dead set on going and playing football and wanted to try to do both, and you know, went to A&M out of high school and had success on the baseball field, both at A&M and at Kansas State, which is great.
You know, one of the things Matt expressed to me as time progressed was his number of concussions that he suffered on the football field. And we all remember, you know, the Holiday Bowl, of course, where he got KO'd and Brian Kavanaugh came in and had a great game. But as someone that's still in the football game, how troubling is the CTE issue and how much did you see it reflect in your own brother?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, it's pretty clear that the concussion issues that players have suffered are lingering. And I'm very excited that the NFL and doctors are now more clued in on that. It's obviously the weight of evidence is there that, you know, something needs to be done. And a lot of advances have been made in the game. And there's just so many things from a safety standpoint that, you know, we used to do even as, you know, you used to bang your helmet against other players trying to, you know, get yourself fired up for a game. Or I remember you used to try to, you know, give yourself streaks on your helmet and you would bash your helmet against somebody else. You know, things that you just didn't do that were not logical on your own decisions that you would make that you obviously do not do anymore. And with Matt, you know, I think Matt took responsibility for a lot of the poor decisions, some of the poor decisions that he made in life, as we all make bad decisions. Matt never cast those off on anything other than mistakes that he made. But I do think that some of the amount of concussions he had will explain, you know, I think CTE played a part in some of the decisions he made. And so we'll be interested. You know, he donated his brain tissue upon his death. That's usually an 8 to 10 month process. So I would guess in the next month or two, we will get those results back and see if CTE did play a part. I will be absolutely shocked if he did not suffer from some form of CTE, and it wouldn't surprise me if he had a significant amount of brain trauma from, you know, different athletic events and sporting events that he played in.
That
was kind of his nature. You know, he was a tough kid, and he did not want to, you know, knowing what you know now, should he have sat out sometimes or sat himself out? Should we have pulled him out? Yeah, probably. But you know, you just didn't know that back then. And I think now that we're aware of it, studies like this will help everybody out. So I'm glad that he was wanting and willing to do that.
Yeah, I find it I too will be shocked if he didn't have damage. And I think we'll all look back and realize a lot of his substance issues probably were self-medicating to help through those things. And I don't like to talk about Matt's substance issues because that didn't define him. It was just part of his journey. And I've had, you know, people bring it up. Did it cause prostate cancer? No, it didn't. It didn't. No, it had nothing to do with that. That is not the entirety of Matt Miller's being, was that he had issues. And maybe it was just in his nature, but I suspect it had something to do with the concussions. And it's funny, Marty, I look back at photos of Matt when he played. That helmet he's wearing in the 1990s, which we think of as modern football, it looks closer to like the helmet you got at Christmas as a little kid than it does to what we're wearing now on the football field.
Right.
It just looks like a toy helmet, and it probably offered very limited protection to concussion.
Well, we've definitely, I have a son who plays football, and you know, the advances in technology are amazing. And I think part of that is due to the fact that people have raised awareness about the issues. Now, I agree with you that, you know, I think that they probably did play a part in some of the decisions he made, but he would never say anything other than it was his responsibility. He took responsibility for the decisions he made, and I think that was always something that was admirable about him.
He's a quarterback. It's quarterback.
No doubt.
The receiver ran the wrong route, but my fault. You know, you just take responsibility. It's funny. You started this off talking about, as Matt, as a little kid, and how he grew up into being such a tough sucker. It's amazing how that works. And he was so tough during his cancer journey. He just put up with so much. I was inspired by him, honestly, brother.
I think everybody was. Anybody who, you know, it was obvious when you came to the hospital that last week of his life, you know, when he would get up from the bed to use the restroom, you really could see the pain just in moving. And then when you saw his body and the, you know, cancer, there's no easy way to describe what had happened to his body except for it had fallen apart.
Right.
You know, it was bruised and beaten, and it just, you felt so sorry for him, and just the amount of pain he was in. And it was evident that, you know, he was not complaining about it. He never complained, but, you know, he fought cancer to the very end. And my wife said it was like the Dylan Thomas, you know, poem, "Do not go gentle into the dark night." And that's how Matt was. He fought and fought and fought. And I think one thing that was, if you don't mind me telling another story about the end there, was when I got to the hospital, Matt was on pretty heavy medicine to pain medicine. And so during the course of the day, there were limits to how much they could give him. But so there were times where you were talking to him and he wasn't all there. But soon after a day or two of being there, I realized when he woke up in the middle of the night, usually around 2 or 3 in the morning, and it was a great situation from a setup, is he had a room. And then there was an adjacent suite. And so when I arrived on the 31st, I did not have to leave the hospital any night. And we were able to, friends and family were able to sleep in this suite next to him. And so you would hear him get up and use the restroom, and I would go and talk to him at 2 or 3 in the morning. And he was very lucid during that time and was talking. And it was like having the old Matt back. And, you know, during that time, one time he said, "You know, I feel like I know I'm dying, but shouldn't feel like," he said, "I just don't feel like I'm dying. I know my body's breaking down on me. I just don't feel like it's time to die." And he said that, you know, it just was breaking your heart to hear him talk. And he said, "The thing that scares me the most is the actual moment of death. You know, just that I won't be around anymore." So the only thing that gives me comfort in that time is, he said, it's like a mantra in my mind. He said, "I just repeat the words from John 3:16 over and over again in my head." And so he used that Bible verse as kind of, as, you know, a calming influence for him. He said, "Whenever I worry about the actual moment of death, I just repeat this over and over again." Now, if you go forward a few days, towards the end when he was unconscious, you know, we did not ever have him alone in the room. He, from the moment, from Christmas Day on, there was someone in the room with Matt always. And, you know, they would tell you stories in the hospital about people hanging on until certain family members come and visit. But I think it was the opposite with Matt. I don't think he wanted to pass away with people in the room with him. I don't think he just loved everybody so much that he didn't want people there. And so after a while, we just decided, you know, people started, less and less visitors we were allowing in. And, you know, we got down to the last day or two, and it was me and his oldest daughter were there on the last day. And I went to take a shower on that Saturday evening, and she had gone out for a walk and had come back. And I said, hey, now that you're back, I'm going to run down and take a shower. So I ran down to the floor below us, took a shower. I came back up from taking the shower. And when I walked in the room, when I was walking into the room, I saw his daughter walking into the room, and I heard her kind of yell out, you know, in agony and tears that, you know, it was clear that Matt was gone. And what had happened, Matt was having some trouble breathing, and she called the nurses in. And when that happened, they would readjust him. And she left to go use the restroom while they were readjusting him. And he passed away in that 1 minute where there was no family or friends with him. And
I think you're right.
You know, I just don't think he wanted to pass away with family or friends around. And, you know, one thing that was amazing about that was his daughter Mia was just so heartbroken that she wasn't there for the actual moment, because we wanted to be there with him to comfort him. And she said, you know, it was the weirdest thing, Uncle Marty. When I got up to leave, I started walking out of the room, and I went back in, and I whispered in his ear, John 3:16, for some reason. He said, I don't know why I did that, but I just felt the need to share a Bible verse with him. And I said, well, did I had to have told you about him saying that when he was afraid to die, that his mantra was John 3:16. She said, Marty, nobody ever told me that. Mm. And just, you know, I think it was, whether you believe in divine inspiration or not, I think, you know, for her in that moment to just say that to him was a comfort to him, to say, you know, it was allowing him to pass on. She walked out of the room, and 30 seconds after she said that to him, he passed away. And, you know, it was just, I think that gave us comfort, all of us comfort, that he didn't want to pass away with us in the room or around. He didn't want us to see him go. And so he was comforted with the fact that the room was the first time the room had been empty in nearly 2 weeks. And he passed away in that 1 minute window where no one was there with him. It was, and if that's the way he chose to go, you know, man, I'm glad he got to go out on his terms.
Right? I agree.
You know, that meant a lot to all of us.
He might not physically be with us, but he's always with us, man. I think of him often. He inspired me. Bless you. I mean, I look forward to seeing you in July, and
definitely. We can all sit around so much,
and laugh and make fun of Bucky a little bit.
And I understand that congratulations are in order to you, correct, for your diagnosis, and now you're the optimism of your situation, correct?
Yeah, I was declared in remission in December, and, you know, in the big picture, it doesn't mean much, but it means you're not down 30, you're up at halftime, and
there's no doubt.
You got to hang on to the lead. Marty, thank you so much for your time. It was great.
Thank you for everything.
Okay. Love you, brother. I'll see you in July.
Yep. Love you too. Appreciate it. Thank you.
That took a lot out of me. We didn't get into this. Marty is fighting Parkinson's. It seems like the Miller family is going through a lot of challenges right now. The loss of Matt and Father Les were just catastrophic to be so close together. But Matt should have had a lot of life left, and he didn't. But in some ways, he lives on. I'll be so happy to get together with other friends and people, honestly, I haven't met, to talk about Matt in July when they have the memorial here in Kansas. Always try to tie these episodes up in a neat little bow at the end with a little something. I've learned a lot from having cancer, and one of them is I'm spiritual. Not really religious. I mean, the fact that I don't go to organized service that often. But I'm a believer. And I also believe you need to tell everyone that you love them. If it's family or friend or a wife or children, just a buddy or someone you really don't know that well, but have shared something. That's me and Marty. John 3:16. For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish, but have eternal life. I'll talk to you next week on The Life of Fitz.
When you have sports mixed with your pop culture, along with humor and celebrity interviews, your earbuds are enjoying the Rich Eisen Show.
Dan Orlovsky, are you still a Jaden Daniels is the best quarterback available in the draft guy?
I think the three things that make it stand out for me are, number one, I think his ball placement versus man coverage is the best in the draft. Every quarterback in the NFL is accurate. He's got the best on tape. Number two, most transferable stuff to the NFL. And then I think the third thing is pocket peace.
Search for the Rich Eisen Show on YouTube or wherever you listen.